Hello, this is Terrence McNally. As the Republican Congress moves closer to passing its tax bill aimed at rewarding the 1% and large corporations, stiffing the middle class, and adding to the deficit in order to shrink government, here's my 2010 conversation with Raj Patel about his book, The Value of Nothing, How to Reshape Market Society and Redefine Democracy.
In his last speech to the Southern Christian Leadership Conference in 1967, Martin Luther King said, and this is going to be a fairly long quote, but I want to set this show up. One day, we must ask the question, why are there 40 million poor people in America? And when you begin to ask that question, you are raising questions about the economic system, about a broader distribution of wealth. When you ask that question, you begin to question the capitalist economy. And I'm simply saying that more and more, we've got to begin to ask questions about the whole society. We are called upon to help the discouraged beggars in life's marketplace. But one day we must come to see that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring. It means that questions must be raised. You see, my friends, when you deal with this, you begin to ask the question, who owns the oil? You begin to ask the question, who owns the iron ore? You begin to ask the question, why is it that people have to pay water bills in a world that is two-thirds water? These are questions that must be asked. Found that quote on Raj Patel's website. And remember that King died while the middle and working classes in America, better, of course, if you were white and male, but the middle and working classes were still making progress. Real wages in the U.S. rose from World War II until 1973. They've been relatively stagnant or worse ever since. And then came the latest crash, and jobs and homes are lost, pensions and retirements are wiped out, and Wall Street reaps unprecedented rewards for unprecedented failure. So, we are going to ask some of the questions King said we must. Raj Patel has released a new book, The Value of Nothing, How to Reshape Market Society and Redefine Democracy. Opening with Oscar Wilde's observation that nowadays people know the price of everything and the value of nothing, he shows how our faith in prices as a way of valuing the world is misplaced. He reveals the hidden ecological and social cost of a hamburger, as much as $200. A hamburger. And asks how we came to have markets in the first place. Both the corporate capture of government and our current financial crisis, Patel argues, are a result of our democratically bankrupt political system. So, back to basics in both economics and politics. On Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Raj Patel has worked for the World Bank and the WTO and been tear gassed on four continents protesting against them. Writer, activist, academic, he's currently a visiting scholar at UC Berkeley Center for African Studies, a researcher at the School of Development Studies at the University of KwaZulu-Natal, and a fellow at the Institute for Food and Development Policy, also known as Food First. He's the author of Stuffed and Starved, and his latest, The Value of Nothing, How to Reshape Market Society and Redefine Democracy. Welcome, Raj Patel, to Pacifica and KPFK and Free Forum.
It's great to be here, Terrence. Thank you.
Thank you. Now, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we're going to talk about. So tell us a bit about your path, and obviously, in a bio where one has worked for and protested against the same organizations, there's a path there to be talked about.
Well, I mean, I'm a sort of child of imperialism, or as it's more recently called, globalization. I've come from a background where my family were sort of scattered to the winds. That my father was born in Fiji, my mother in Kenya, and I grew up in Britain, but very concerned about the links between different places. And very concerned about how to fight poverty in those places. I mean, I was lucky enough, being born in a diaspora community, to be taken to the global south a great deal, and to spend time looking at staring poverty in the face. And so I was very concerned about how to fight that poverty, and essentially I've been doing that for a number of years. When I was in the process of my graduate studies, again looking at poverty in the global south, there came an opportunity to work at the World Bank and the World Trade Organization. The World Trade Organization, I was merely an intern, but I was taking intelligence about how the organization worked to social movements who were very interested in how that organization worked. And when I was at the World Bank, I was offered the opportunity to write a report that was that had access to the World Bank's classified internal documents, looking at how they represented poverty and poor people to themselves. Unfortunately, the access that I got was access in order to be able to produce a puff piece that the World Bank then published under the title of Voices of the Poor, Can Anyone Hear Us? In which the World Bank proclaimed quite loudly that that it knew poor people very well, and some of its best friends were poor, and that was unacceptable, and I resigned soon after. The professor who actually gave me the job resigned from the World Bank as well.
Can I cut in for just a second?
Of course.
This experience of yours reminds me a bit of Joe Stiglitz, and even more specifically of Herman Daly. I don't know if you know his experience. He was working for the World Bank, and they were putting out a brochure about globalization. And they showed a picture of kind of the world economy, and he said, but there should be a frame around it.
Right.
And they said no, and he said, but there must be, and it went back and forth, and finally they wouldn't allow the frame, which to Herman Daly means that the world and nature have limits, that an economy does not exist in some abstract place, and he resigned the World Bank after that.
Well, yes, I'm quite pleased to be part of a tradition of people who discover that the World Bank, however much it protests that it is interested in poverty and sustainability, turns out not to be. The fact that some pretty good people have sort of run away from the World Bank in disgust is a sign, I think, that first, the World Bank does, the people who remain at the World Bank aren't evil, but they are, they're concerned about fighting poverty in developing countries, but they're beholden to an ideology that they cannot see and that they cannot change. Once that ideology becomes clear, that there's a dissonance between people who point out that it is this ideology that is responsible for destruction in developing countries, and people who remain loyal to an ideology that is in fact bankrupt. And it's that bankruptcy of the ideology that actually is one of the starting points of the value of nothing.
Right. And before we talk about the value of nothing, could you tell people just a little bit about Stuffed and Starved?
Sure. I mean, Stuffed and Starved was a book that I wanted to write when I was at the at Food First, which is also the Institute for Food and Development Policy in Oakland, in California. What I wanted to do was basically join the dots to explain how it is that the United States has such epidemic levels of hunger, epidemic levels of obesity, and yet at the same time there are globally epidemic levels of hunger. We now live in a world where there are a billion people who are overweight and a billion people who are starving. For a while, of course, it was it was a revelation to point out that hunger happened in America, as well as obesity, of course. The tragedy is that now that contradiction between obese and hungry is one that's even more magnified in the United States. When we found out, for example, last year that in 2008. Over 49 million Americans went hungry in the United States, at the same time as the United States was the most obese population on Earth. This contradiction that exists worldwide certainly exists in the United States. In Stuffed and Starved, what I try to do is explain why these two things were not accidental, but actually they're the outcomes of a very complex system in which corporate power both underpays labor, particularly the labor that produces food, and tries to sell us profitable food, which means that it sells us food that is systematically bad for us. And that's why we see a world with increasing levels of obesity and increasing levels of hunger.
Very good. Let me tell people, I'm Terrence McNally, speaking with Raj Patel, author of Stuffed and Starved, and his new book, The Value of Nothing, How to Reshape Market Society and Redefine Democracy. You can learn more about his work at rajpatel.org. That's RAJPATEL, rajpatel, one word, .org. One thing I plan to do, we've got an hour, and I plan to do some of what you do in The Value of Nothing, which is go into those history lessons and those economics lessons. But before we do, let me read one quick quote in which you say that the That markets, this is a quote early in the book, that markets should know best is a relatively recent article of faith. It took a great deal of ideological and political work to make it part of government's conventional wisdom. So before we get into the history and the economics, how did this well-constructed belief in the market impact, this is to give people examples, the Wall Street bubble, the food crisis of I guess it was last year, year and a half, the crash, and perhaps the recovery or reform. So applying that belief, how did it impact those four events?
Well, I mean, essentially the idea that markets know best means that government regulation and oversight in various forms was pretty systematically dismantled in the 1970s, 1980s, 1990s. And that regulation took a great deal of forms. I mean, whether it was protection for union organizing, for example, whether it was things like creating banking regulation and oversight, whether it was things like food grain reserves in the United States and elsewhere, or whether it was the ability for people to organize and to be able to think about a role for government and the state that was anything other than cutting taxes and letting the free market do its thing. These are all things that were lost when the ideology of markets know best triumphed. Let's take, for example, the food crisis. The reason we had a food crisis wasn't really because of a shortage of food. I mean, there were odd things happening in the global food supply, and there were strange events that affected a few grain baskets here and there. But in the main, the driving force behind a lot of the volatility in food markets was speculation. Was the ability of capital that had flowed from, say, speculating on oil prices, that money was able to speculate on the price of food. And all of a sudden, the price of food went up by 30%, for example, in a single day when we were thinking about rice.
Now, just in case anybody didn't hear that or missed it as they were driving, the price of rice went up 30% in one day?
That's right. I mean, there was some dodgy policy that happened in Southeast Asia at the same time as global markets were incredibly tight, and there was a lot of speculation. And all of a sudden, the interconnectedness of global markets in rice meant the price of rice jumped. And you saw a soaring food prices in 2008 for a variety of reasons, a lot to do with the interconnectedness of these world markets. But because there weren't ways in which local suppliers could kick in, there weren't ways in which locally sourced rice, for example, was able to be produced and released to the market in a way that was acceptable to everyone. Those food price rises led to protests, and in fact, Haiti is a perfect example of how market fundamentalism destroyed an economy. I mean, we've seen the disaster of Haiti right now.
Mm-hmm.
At the beginning of the 1980s, Haiti grew the majority of its own rice. But because people in Haiti wanted a left-wing government, and because two U.S. presidents didn't think that was a good idea, Presidents Reagan and Clinton, those presidents negotiated for Haiti a structural adjustment loan from the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. And basically what that meant was that Haiti, a very indebted country, would be given money in order to pay off its debts as long as it opened its economy to this free market, the market knows best mentality. The trouble is that there is no free market. There's no free market in food, for sure. And when you have Haitian rice farmers who earn $2 a day if they're lucky, competing against U.S. rice farmers who get $1 billion a year in subsidy, it's not surprising that Haitian rice farmers first panicked to try and produce more rice just to be able to survive, and then in the end gave up to become sweatshop workers in the cities. And the consequence of that is that in 2008, there were vigorous protests around food. First of all, demanding the return of a democratically elected president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who was deposed in an international coup, which the U.S. seems to be very heavily involved in.
Mm-hmm.
But also demanding bags of rice that came from the United States. It came from these billion-dollar-a-year rice farm industry in the United States that had the words on them, gift of the people of the United States. So that gives you some sense of how the markets have been actually politically enforced in places that didn't want them, and how this market knows best mentality turns out to be a tool with which poorer people are subjugated to the needs of the most powerful.
Right, and I did a show not that long ago with I'm forgetting his first name right now, Philippe Diaz, the director of The End of Poverty. Mm-hmm. And that film really goes into that particular aspect of it in great depth. The fact for any who aren't aware, what happens is if you take someone who can feed his family or a community that can feed themselves and you shift them into the global marketplace, now as long as the prices work and things are fine and they are able to compete with that subsidized produce from richer countries, they're okay. But as soon as that breaks, they no longer have the life raft of their own food to feed them. I'm speaking with Raj Patel. He is the author of Stuffed and Starved earlier and his new book, The Value of Nothing. You can learn more about his work at Raj Patel. That's RAJPATEL.org. So thank you for bringing it down to the level of looking at why Haiti is as poor, as desperate as it is. As I said, so that's the food crisis, how the market impacted that. The rule that the market rules, how about the Wall Street bubble and the crash?
Well, again, I mean, what you had in that case was a series of decisions around regulation, around what the banks thought that they ought to be able to regulate themselves, the extent to which they could manage their capital bases. But they also had an ideology. They also had something called the efficient markets hypothesis, which was the idea that actually, if you let markets reign freely, that all knowledge that is available in the market will be brought to bear, and markets will indeed be able to price assets correctly. But there was also a problem in the way, of course, that the compensation in Wall Street was structured, because if the market really prices everything exactly and correctly the minute that it hits the market, there's no room for anyone to make any profit. And so there was a sort of inbuilt incentive into the way that Wall Street was set up for people to be able to systematically ignore the risks in certain financial products and in certain kinds of trade. And the idea was that if they could shuffle off that risk into the next quarter, that this quarter they would be rewarded handsomely and their bonuses would be high. And so by basically gaming the system with a system of regulation that encouraged them, that they authored and therefore allowed a certain kind of playing fast and loose with the numbers, it was possible for huge amounts of systematic risk to be kicked off into the future and to be ignored through some creative accounting on balance sheets. And then, of course, when the catastrophic risk was realized, that's when everyone ran for the hills and all of a sudden started demanding public support. And of course, this is one of the ironies of this idea of the free market. We're told that free markets are almost God-given things, they fall from the sky, when in fact they are very much human-made. Free markets very much depend on governments to be able to pick them up when they fall.
Right, and let's take the trip then, as I said we would, into the history, because your book is basically divided into two sections. The first half deals with the evolution of this ideology and its power, and then the second half gives us some models and some signposts of things which are happening which may restore sanity and humanity to global society and the way people live. So let's go in that first part, this history lesson. You make the point, and I think it's very true, very accurate, that people now, as I think we live in a shorter term attention span than ever, just kind of think that as it is, it has always been. And what you do is you lay out that the market, the particular ways of looking even at human nature, the whole idea of value and price were not ever so. Could you take us through some of that development? And I assume in there we'll hear a bit about Locke, a bit about Hobbes, a bit about Adam Smith and Marx.
Sure. Well, I mean, of course, the idea that price and value are different things was something that goes all the way, in fact, back to Aristotle, where the idea of what does something cost in a market is basically a sort of trivial question. The Greek for it is chresmatistics, where it's basically just the science of what it is that markets produce as prices. But that's very different from oikonomia, from the business of provisioning and distributing resources within the household. If Aristotle knew about it, certainly all the modern political economists knew that there was there's something going on behind the scenes. So although a price is the most sort of superficial example of the economy at work, what all the major economists, certainly Adam Smith and Karl Marx, were interested in finding out was not what something cost in the market. They knew very well that supply and demand, scarcity and availability were the determinants for what something cost. But they wanted they were investigators. They were detectives trying to figure out what happens. Why is it that something really costs what it does? And for Smith and for Marx, certainly, the question came down to labor. It came down to work, to the question of how is it? There's something different about the way about work and about labor than anything else that goes into a good, because labor is what it is that transforms something from being a sort of static, inanimate part of nature into something that has much more value. And this idea of a labor theory of value is why Adam Smith thought that the real value of everything was essentially the trouble that went into the making of it. Now Adam Smith had essentially this sort of fundamental theory of how labor worked, but he also had a much more sophisticated idea of how it was that the economy was structured so that some people who were workers were systematically different from landowners, who in turn were systematically different from the merchants who profited from the behavior of and from the employment of laborers. Karl Marx took that idea much further and systematized it much more thoughtfully into an explanation of why it is that capitalism looks the way that it does, and why modern capitalism actually is always going to do things like squeeze out environmental costs, externalize the environmental costs while internalizing the profits, if you like. And in fact, Marx also brought in another intervention that I think is tremendously important, which is that one thing that modern capitalism doesn't do is pay for household work. Modern capitalism doesn't pay for the business of making new labor, new laborers, new workers. Essentially, that means that the business of bringing up kids, of educating them, of building new community, all of that won't be paid for by capitalism, because that's a subsidy that capitalism needs in order to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do the math, if you figure out how much women's unpaid work would cost if we were to pay a market value for it, as some UN researchers did a little while ago, they came up with the idea that actually, in 1995, women's work was valued at $17 trillion, which is pretty much half the total world output in 1995.
And by the way, that was only counting the women's work that is not monetized, not also the women's work that is monetized?
No, that would be the total. The 11 trillion is not monetized, and the total is 17 trillion.
Got it.
But that's there's a huge gulf then between what it is that women do get paid and don't get paid.
Sure.
And the amount of women's work that features in the economy is way, is a massive amount. And yet, of course, women own less than 10% of the world's resources in developing countries, and less than 10% of the land. Again, this is not an accident. This is integral to the way that the system works.
Okay. I'm Terrence McNally. The voice you hear is Raj Patel, who, as you can tell from the way his mind is working and the rapidity with which he's speaking, has a lot to say in a new book, The Value of Nothing. And you can learn more at rajpatel.org. Very, very important notion, which has been arising more lately than after being, I think, completely off people's charts for years, is that of the commons. And the piece that I found particularly interesting in your discussion of it, because I've come across the commons in the work of Lawrence Lessig, in the work of David Bollier and so on, talking about the electronic commons and things like this. But what its relationship to the environment and pollution and so on. But you point out that the enclosure of the commons made so much of what we see now as sort of this God-given economic infrastructure possible.
Well, that's right, Terrence. I mean, there is a hidden history to this word, the commons. And it's not one that we're familiar with. I mean, in general, the way that people know about the commons is through the tragedy of the commons,
right,
where an unowned resource, a resource that no single person has managed to put under private property. The idea of the tragedy of the commons is that when all of us have access to a resource that no one owns, that we will be selfish and greedy and individual and just go in and use that resource up and with eyes wide open. The tragedy is that we will destroy the resource that we know that we depend on. And that's the tragedy, is that because we are selfish and greedy, we will tragically overconsume and leave ourselves with nothing.
Right.
The trouble is that this idea of the tragedy of the commons was actually a thought experiment. It was a piece published by a soil biologist called Garrett Hardin in 1968. He published it in the journal Science. When you hear it as a thought experiment, it sounds kind of reasonable. You know, if people are all selfish and greedy and they go for something, of course, there'll be nothing left after a while.
And if I'm not mistaken, he was putting it out there in some sense as a warning.
Well, that's right. I mean, he was celebrated in some ways as an environmental figure.
Right.
And yet, if you think about how it is, I mean, there's something wrong with this picture. And what's wrong with it is that if you look at the history of the commons, of resources that no one once owned in the United Kingdom, in Italy, around the world, there are systems of resources that no one owns. And it turns out that people are pretty good, actually, at managing resources that no one owns so that they don't get destroyed and overrun. And so if that's true, then something's wrong with Garrett Hardin's assumption.
Right. Can I get in for a second and just say that it seems to me that one of the great examinations of this question is Jared Diamond's book Collapse.
That's right.
In which he looks at, 15, and he made a point of half of the societies that he talks about collapsed, and half of them did not.
That's right. And of course, I mean, it's interesting this idea of the commons, of what causes that collapse versus what causes sustainability, is now something that we're getting increasingly interested in. And in fact, the latest Nobel Prize in economics was won by Eleanor Ostrom, a woman for the first time, who won it in part for her work on the commons. And what she found is something that should shock us a little bit. I mean, we're so used to thinking of ourselves as selfish and greedy. But it turns out that human beings are really good at organizing. And human beings are really good at, while, of course, we are selfish and greedy, we are also other things. We are also cooperative and altruistic and generous and capable of negotiating agreements that we in general abide by. And if we don't abide by them, then we also have regimes of punishment that make sure that fairness is maintained. And we're so good at that, in fact, that when a recent study came out looking at different forest communities and how forest communities were managing their forests. This is a study that came out of the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And what they found was that forest communities that had autonomy, in other words, that didn't have the private sector or the government coming in, and also had enough forest for them to be able to use sustainably, well, actually, those communities not only did better for the people in the communities, in other words, there were higher levels of welfare and development indicators and what have you, but they also sequestered more carbon. In other words, they managed the forest so much better that they were able to lock away carbon that benefits all of us. And they did this not because they were selfish and greedy, but because despite being selfish and greedy, they were also good at living with the economic consequences of their actions and learning from them. And that's something that markets don't teach us how to do.
This is Terrence McNally. You're listening to my August 2010 conversation with Raj Patel about his book, The Value of Nothing: How to Reshape Market Society and Redefine Democracy.
You say, although I think we've still got a bit of work to do on the economics of it, is that it's this joining of politics and economics, or government and the market, that has really taken off and really distorted things over the last 100 years, 75 years?
Well, yes. I think that's right. I mean, again, this gets back to the point about markets being manufactured. Markets are things that we allow to happen, and the ways in which we allow things to enter markets and to markets to push the frontiers back, well, you know, there's nothing natural about that. It is the function of government. I mean, that's why even someone like Adam Smith was very worried about the power of, for example, corporations, or the power of the very rich to actually dominate the poorest in society. So yes, absolutely, there has been a breakdown in the boundary between the market and the rest of society.
And a little bit of the evolution there. In other words, when this notion of the market and its power over everything, you cite a few people. And one question I have about that is, you know, you mentioned Fama, and you mentioned Becker, and Friedman, and those folks, right? Mm. Ayn Rand, and so on. As I read a book like that, I go, do those theoreticians actually make that much difference? Are they actually leading people somewhere, or are they just mapping what people have already been doing?
Well, yes, I talk a lot in the book about how these ideologues for the free market, these apologists, if you like, are useful in pushing forward a free market doctrine that suits the very powerful. And of course, it's a bit of both. I mean, on the one hand, particularly in the Cold War, the right and the sort of free marketeers were able to insinuate their ideology into the war on communism. And at the same time, this was tremendously useful for the rich in the United States to be able to say, yes, of course, we're part of the war on communism, tax us less. And at the same time, you know, the prevalence of the ideology makes certain courses of action thinkable. It makes it possible to actually head down routes that you wouldn't have if the ideology wasn't there in the first place. So there's definitely a sort of back and forth relation between power and the ideologies that power produces. So I do think someone like Ayn Rand, for example, is an important part of the story of the acceptability of free markets in the United States. But it is interesting to me, and I think this is a point that's worth hanging on to. Whether it's Gary Becker, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, who thinks that there should be a market in women, we should allow polygamy, so that women who aren't able to command a good price for themselves as a first wife can make a good market, can get a price for them as a second wife. Which is, of course, a preposterous idea.
And now, when he said that, by the way, he didn't say that as if it were preposterous. Am I correct? We're not just
No, that's right. No,
this wasn't
a
self.
Serious.
a self-parodic article he wrote.
No. This for him was an example of how, if you use markets, you know, thinking about economics properly, that you will show that. He proved with a few diagrams that actually you increased welfare for women if you allowed them to marry, because otherwise you would have unmarriable women who were by themselves, whereas if they could be a second wife, they would get, you know, they would get some return for themselves in the marriage market. It's an awful, awful argument. But this is the interesting thing, that actually, and I talk about this in the book, markets aren't bad by themselves. I mean, markets always, I mean, there are some civilizations and cultures that exist today where markets are tremendously good. The markets are associated with meeting people you don't know and developing bonds of trust and of sociality and of generosity. Markets aren't bad. It's just that capitalist markets are premised on certain relations of exploitation and of power that are bad for the environment, that are bad for society, that are good for just a handful of people and bad for the rest of us. But markets themselves aren't a bad thing. It's just that there has been this hijack of the idea of markets over the past, the rise of particularly the far right economists of sort of Milton Friedman stripe since the 1970s. That kind of economics has really done the idea of markets a great deal of harm.
And now, I mean, it turns out, you know, we focus, I think, when we look at these questions at the U.S. and then maybe second most the U.K. How has this become the global problem that it is, when Europe had, you know, had a nice tradition of social democracy with safety nets and a seemingly different social contract?
Well, I mean, but part of it has, to some extent, that social contract persists, though it is under siege in Europe. And part of it is to do with, certainly the reason it's become a global problem is through the export of this kind of free market fundamentalism through organizations like the World Trade Organization and the World Bank, but also through direct U.S. economic policy and intervention, and British and European, in fact. I mean, you know, the European Union is quite happy to have its safety nets at home. But in its official development policy, it joins the United States in insisting that developing countries should not be allowed the right to invest in their own people or in develop their own industries or this sort of thing. And so, in that sense, you know, Europe is two-faced about its development economics.
Yeah, two-faced in a different way than we are. The U.S. espouses things which it doesn't actually do. The Europe actually does them for themselves, but just doesn't.
But prevents them from.
They're worth doing for anyone else.
Right.
I'm speaking with Raj Patel about his book, The Value of Nothing: How to Reshape Market Society and Redefine Democracy. Funny, before we go into the way out of this this terrible forest we found ourselves in, a little bit more about price, value, and externalities, and maybe the hamburger and that sort of thing.
Sure. Well, I mean, this is the example that captures sort of people's imaginations, that the value of, we're familiar with paying whatever it is, $4 for a double cheeseburger. But what we're not familiar with is the way in which the corporation that produced that that food has managed to squeeze out the hidden costs of the way we consume. And some researchers in India said, look, if we were to value the, say, for example, the rainforest that was destroyed so that pasture could be, so that the cattle could be raised on pasture on that land, well, how much would it cost? And so they sat down and they said, all right, well, we lose biodiversity, we lose the nutrient cycles of the rainforest, we lose, we lose the carbon, we lose the oxygen being produced, and we can impute a dollar value to that. And if we do, then it turns out that our $4 hamburger costs $200. And that's just the environmental cost. That doesn't even include the hidden cost of labor in the food. I mean, in The Value of Nothing, I talk about how, for example, if in the United States, our burgers will come with tomatoes, and this time of year, in the winter, those tomatoes will likely come from Florida. And if they do, then the chances are that the people who were picking those tomatoes were getting paid pennies for a 48-pound bucket of tomatoes. And since 1997, over 1,000 people have been freed from conditions of modern-day slavery, like seriously slavery. The people who were prosecuted for this were prosecuted under the articles that constituted abolition in this country. People were really being paid pennies for a day's work, and then being forced to pay for things like showers. And when you're working with pesticides every day, you need a shower. And some people found it cheaper to wash their hands with bleach than to actually pay to have a shower.
Yeah,
features in the price of a hamburger.
Right. Let me just jump in there. We've done a few shows here with Ben Skinner and others about the magnitude of slavery in the world at this time. But I did that. That particular thing was absolutely news to me. That in this country, 1,000 people have been freed? Is that what it is?
That's right. And if you talk to the Coalition of Immokalee Workers in Southern Florida, they'll say that actually that 1,000 is just what the police have managed to liberate. The number is much, much higher, the number of people who remain in slavery today.
Right. And the idea of one other thing I wanted to add in that hamburger is that also doesn't include, that $200 doesn't include the health costs.
Right, exactly, because of course, these are just the costs that precede, that go into the production. But then we eat the hamburger, and it's part of a diet that is causing us to be massively overweight and to be very sick. I mean, and in this country, 1 in 3 kids born after 2000 will develop diabetes. 1 in 2 minorities will develop diabetes, and 1 in 5 of our healthcare dollars is already being spent on treating someone with diabetes. That's billions of dollars.
Oh, my God, I didn't know that.
Yes, over $180 billion a year already treating someone who has diabetes. And that figure is already catastrophic. We already pay for the way that we eat today. But of course, the burger companies don't have to foot that bill. We do. So these costs are not just sort of magic numbers that economists just sort of make up. But these are real costs that are being borne in the main by people in developing countries. I mean, I write about the debt that we owe developing countries from the way that we consume today being in the trillions of dollars. But even in this country, particularly for working families, the way we eat today is a debt that we're already having to pay off. And again, that never features in the price of food, which is why I say that cheap food is, in fact, cheat food.
Yeah, right?
With a T, exactly. I mean, because the companies that make it manage to cheat their way out of paying the full cost.
Right. And I mean, and obviously with it isn't just the food in this country. It's the food, it's the clothing, it's the toys, it's everything. Someone, if you are opting for cheap, someone is probably getting cheated, and maybe millions of people. I'm speaking with Raj Patel. We're talking about his book, The Value of Nothing. You can learn more at Raj Patel, RAJPATEL.org. Got about little less than 15 minutes left. Let's get to your reasons for hope, or your insights into change. In other words, what you say at the very start and what I said at the intro of the show was that there's some very basic questions that haven't been asked. And when you begin to ask these very basic questions as to why something costs the way it does, why people are related the way they are, why systems work the way they do, you then found that there are some very radical activities going on that give some signs of hope. And I invite you to talk about the Immokalee farm workers, the La Villa Campesina, the Zapatistas, etc., because it's a whole new model, it seems to me. And I recently interviewed Rebecca Solnit about her book Hope in the Dark, and found your reasons for hope are very much the same.
Well, that's right. But of course, you began the program by quoting Dr. King, Martin Luther King, about and this is something that people don't really know about Martin Luther King, that he described himself as a democratic socialist, because he started towards the end of his life asking questions not about how do we feed the hungry, but why do the hungry continue to be produced by our system. And And in fact, Dr. King's solutions were ones that I think are tremendously good. Dr. King didn't just say, well, what we need is, you know, more regulation, and what we need is, you know, a better, you know, economic philosophy. We need people to read The Value of Nothing. He was actually engaged in the politics of a practical change, and organizing the Poor People's Campaigns, as he did, was a direct response to asking the question, well, why do we live in a world of poverty, and why does capitalism reign with such awesome power? So the organizations that I see doing tremendous work are ones, I mean, you know, if we're interested in democracy, I mean, it's important for us to realize that in the United States, we don't really live in a proper democracy. We live in a kind of complainocracy where, you know, every 2 years we have the chance to boot out officials who have disappointed us and replace them with officials who have yet to disappoint us. but what we don't have is the kind of thriving democracy that, you know, Athens did, for example, 2,000 years ago. Now, you know, I mean, I don't want to live in 2,000 years ago Athens, but I do think there's something interesting about it, which is that Athens was the place where democracy was originally born, and in Athens, there were never any elections. Electoral politics had nothing to do with democracy. In fact, in Athens, when you were elected, the way that governments were elected was at random, through a lottery.
Oh, right, yeah.
At the beginning of every year, 6,000 people were chosen at random from, you know, again, picked through a lottery to become the government for a year. And then after that year, they were disbanded, and another 6,000 were chosen. And people who did not want to be part of that that governing procedure were called idiots. Now, the pale vestige of that we have is, of course, the jury system. But there are communities where that kind of democracy is taken very seriously, and you know, the Zapatistas in southern Mexico are a good example. But you don't have to go to southern Mexico to find really exciting movements. The international peasant movement La Via Campesina has members here in the United States. I mean, it's an international movement that has 150 million members. But here in the United States, we have the Coalition of Immokalee Workers in southern Florida, who are fighting the slavery we talked about a little earlier on. The National Family Farm Coalition is also a part of this group. And they have a vision about what we need to reclaim our society. And what we need, they argue, is, you know, what's missing in our economy is the right to have rights. You know, if you're rich in a free market, then you do fine. You know, if you're rich in a free market, you have all the freedom that you can shake a stick at. You can get great health care. You can travel wherever you like. You can do whatever you like.
All the freedom money can buy.
Exactly. And of course, but if you are poor in a market economy, then freedom is just another word for nothing you can afford. And really, what these movements are saying is, what we want is a right to have rights. You know, we're not asking for anything special. We just want our rights, and we want the capacity to be able to demand them. And so movements like La Via Campesina are saying, you know what, if we're going to have rights, we need equality in power. We need a democracy where it's possible for every voice to be counted. And so when they talk about this idea of food sovereignty, about, you know, having communities being able to have democratic discussions about food, in this case, they say that the food sovereignty is about an end to all forms of violence against women. And that's an amazing jump.
I must say, when I read that, I thought exactly the same thing. I said, wait a minute, food sovereignty, violence against women, and when you think of how they got to that, through not somebody coming up with a slogan, but through some bubbling up from the bottom set of, you know, conversations, it's very powerful. But go on.
Well, that's it. I mean, of course, you know, and this is important. I mean, it's important to remember that these are peasants, and in English, you know, the word peasant already carries with it a certain kind of pejorative connotation. Like, you know, that guy doesn't know what he's talking about. He's a peasant. He doesn't know his ass from what he's talking about. And yet, of course, you know, some of these amazing political philosophies, like this idea of, you know, an end to all forms of violence against women, is coming from a peasant movement. And what they're saying is this, that if we're serious about equality in power, if we're serious about taking back and having real markets where real exchange can happen, because they're not anti-market, they just want social control of these markets, then actually you need to confront inequality in power wherever it happens, from the heights of the World Trade Organization right down to the household, where permanent inequality still exists under modern capitalism. And this gets back to the idea of the trillions of dollars of subsidy that women's work provide to the way that our markets work today. So this isn't something that people sat down and sort of read Marxist textbooks and figured it out. This was something that was born of direct experience, as you say, Terence. And I think that actually the fact that it does come from direct experience, that it does come from a really concrete attempt to solve real-world problems, well, that's exactly how our organizing should proceed. It's not about finding the right revolutionary manual or reading the right chapter of Ayn Rand or whatever it is,
or even joining the right party or any of that.
Exactly. It transcends that. It's about finding things that work for working people in order to be able to organize, bring them together, and reclaim the power that has been taken away.
Right. That's the voice of Raj Patel. We're talking about the ideas in his book, The Value of Nothing. And his website is Raj Patel, RAJPATEL.org. Got about 5 more minutes. This notion that these people can come together and do this, how do they do it? One of the things I noticed you said about the Zapatistas, for instance, is they do it slowly.
That's right. Yes, in Stuffed and Starved, I talk about slow food, which is a sort of movement that started in Italy of really sort of sitting down and enjoying food. And in the Zapatistas' case, I talk about slow politics. The sort of difficult, prolonged deliberation that leads to good decisions. There are certain things that need to be done very quickly. And so the Zapatistas, for example, they have an ambulance. If you are sick, they do not sit around and ponder what it is that you have and what the best way to reach you is. They'll send the ambulance. But they realize that actually, for a lot of the choices and decisions that we make today, we need to take more time to do them. And that means that actually what we need is discussion. We need to learn the art of deliberating and of having meetings and of disagreeing and of resolving our disagreements. At the moment, of course, again, one of the ways in which we are de-skilled as citizens is that we're not really used to having civilized debate. I mean, we're used to having the kind of rowdy town halls where people will adopt positions of one or other political party as if there are only ever two opinions about any given issue, and then hurl abuse at one another. Whereas in Zapatista meetings, what you have is just a long, really slow process of deliberation to get to what people believe to be the right answer, so that actually people can live, can own a decision and then learn from the consequences if that decision isn't correct. And that's a world away, again, from the kind of democracy that we have right now.
Right. And one of the things someone within the last year told me, I said, what is your politics? And he said, I'm a radical. And he said, not as you think, but from the fact that the root word there, the deeper meaning of radical is root, and that it's about getting below the argument to some very basic, as we're talking about, basic rights.
Right, that's it, of course, but in our sort of accelerated world, and in particular the kind of mad accelerated politics where decisions need to be made instantly, and there's no room for reasoned debate, of course, we never get to the roots of anything. We never get to the radical, the roots of the word radical are, exactly as you say in Latin, comes from, the word radical also comes from the same word as the word root does. We don't have time for that, and of course we need to make time. And it would be futile to expect our politicians in Washington to do that. But what I'm seeing, particularly again in the food movement, but in many other movements as well, is that at the community level in the United States right now, you are seeing people asking root cause questions, just as Dr. King did, as you quoted him so beautifully at the beginning of the hour, asking these tough questions and coming up with answers themselves. And that, to me, is democracy at work, and it's very, very hopeful.
Besides going to your site, rajpatel.org, I have a sense that a lot of this is news to people, that there is another way, that there is an approach that doesn't ask, you know, which party, but which right, and that sort of thing. Where can people learn more? You've got about 2.5 more minutes. What do you finally give to listeners and readers that says it looks like a lot of bad stuff has hit the fan recently, but underneath there's something worth paying attention to, worth becoming involved with, and worth putting your hopes in?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, for me, it's food. And since that's an issue that concerns, as I say, 49 million Americans, it's something that you can get involved in pretty instantly. And there's already stuff going on in your community. If you go to foodfirst.org, an organization that I'm a fellow at, there's a great deal of information about how to get to the root causes of hunger and also how to fight it. There's something called these food policy councils that are springing up around the country and around North America, nearly 100 of them now, that are asking these root cause questions. But if you're not interested in food, that's okay. There's something that you are passionate about, whether it's about healthcare, whether it's about transitioning away from our unsustainable carbon world into something much better. If you're interested in education, if you're interested in criminal justice, if you're interested about the prison system, there are people organizing in your community right now. And all it takes is a few minutes of web searching, or go down to your local library, because librarians are just the gods of information. there is no more noble profession, I don't think. Go to your local librarian, go to your local Pacifica station, ask around. People will know. Whatever movement you're interested in, they'll be able to tell you, they'll be able to hook you up. But ask around in your church, in your local farmer's market, wherever it is. There's always a space in which you can make democracy flourish, and it begins with you.
Very good. Raj Patel's latest book is The Value of Nothing, How to Reshape Market Society and Redefine Democracy. His website is rajpatel.org. That's RAJPATEL. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others at any time during the week by linking to our podcast. You can also sign up to have it delivered to you weekly, either at my site or at iTunes. For podcast articles and transcripts, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net. That's one word, terrencemcnally.net. And if you want to receive my weekly email announcement of upcoming guests and issues, email me at temcnally, one word, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y, at mac.com. Thank you to Melissa Figueroa, my engineer, Stan Mizrahi and Mark Maxwell in production, Matt Perez in traffic, and you, my listeners. I look forward to being with you again next week. Thank you, Raj Patel. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, Terrence.
Whether you're listening to me, Mark Levine, each Monday and Wednesday,
or me, Leslie Marshall, each Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday,
you can hear us 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Voices Network.
Here's a sample of what you'll hear. Congressman Ted Lieu, a Democrat from California, is a member of the House Foreign Affairs and House Judiciary Committees. You are one of the lawmakers, along with other veterans, who are urging our own president to halt his heated words with regard to North Korea. Tell us about this, and please tell us why, sir.
We ask the president to stop making provocative statements against North Korea. Reason I did that is because it's very clear we have no good military options against North Korea. When I served on active duty, I was at Anderson Air Force Base in Guam. I was under U.S. Pacific Air Forces. We always did a series of different military exercises, much of it directed against North Korea. And the problem is we can't contain escalation. We don't know how the North Korean regime would react to military force. And if they go berserk and go crazy, a lot of people are going to die, including hundreds of thousands of Americans.
There was a Pentagon report on what a war with that isolated nation would entail. In addition to what you've just said, is there anything else that the Pentagon report found that people listening should be aware of?
Representative Ruben Gallego and I wrote a letter to the Pentagon asking them to explain to the American public what a war would look like. And they gave us a letter that was very blunt. I think their Joint Chiefs were actually trying to send a message. So first thing they said is we would need a ground invasion. That means we can't just launch 59 cruise missiles like we did in Syria and be done with the issue. This would be a long, protracted, bloody war with a lot of ground forces going into North Korea. And we have so little intelligence on the regime that we don't know where all their nuclear weapons are, nor where they are all located. And they also hide them. So we're going to have to try to find those nuclear weapons and secure them or destroy them And if our ground forces can't do that before they can retaliate, then we're in a lot of trouble because they can detonate a nuclear weapon and kill a lot of Americans and South Koreans.
Yeah, and I want to talk about that briefly, Congressman. We're over here. The people of South Korea are the closest target. And in a sense, anything that is said by this president or any action that we have with North Korea affect one of our strongest allies, especially in that region, South Korea, and the South Korean people themselves.
The president of South Korea, President Moon, has repeatedly stated that there will be no military force without the pre-approval of South Korea. So if the U.S. tries to conduct military operations in North Korea and the South Koreans are not with us, that just makes it 10 times harder. And keep in mind, in the First Korean War, China and Russia supported North Korea. So if they were to do that again in a Second Korean War, then there's no reason to believe that the U.S. can even win that war.
There are a lot of Americans who don't know as much about North Korea, but arguably the people there are brainwashed, and I believe that this madman who leads North Korea would send his peoples to slaughter simply to win a point. And that scares me also for the people of North Korea, because they don't really understand the truth of the world that they're living in and the world that surrounds them outside of those borders.
That is correct. The North Korean regime has done a very good job of brainwashing much of their population. But I have to tell you, their foreign policy experts and intelligence experts, they assess the North Korean leader is not suicidal, that he is rational in the sense that he'll do what he can to preserve his regime, which means that he's unlikely to, in fact, launch a nuclear weapon at the United States, because he knows if he does that, he'll be annihilated. The question is, can we deter him? Can we deter him the same way we would deter China or Russia, which has nuclear weapons? And a lot of how you view North Korea depends on your answer to that question.
Again, that's Mark Levine every Monday and Wednesday.
And Leslie Marshall each Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday.
3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Voices Network.